If you're over the age of 15, you likely remember spending some time practicing your driving skills, but also learning the rules of the road. And so maybe you had a manual that looked something like this, and you spent about 2 weeks before you planned to take the test going through this manual and memorizing all kinds of laws that were deemed to make you a better driver. And if your experience is like most, you then went, you took the test, and upon passing it, you got rid of the driver's manual and forgot most of what you learned about it. That's okay, because many of those rules we are not going to put into practice every day. However, the problem is, this is sometimes how we approach the Bible. We view it in a similar manner to this driver's manual. We look at all of these rules. Maybe we try to commit all of these rules to memory. But then we end up in one of two very bad situations. One of those situations might simply be to look at this and say, there's absolutely no way I can ever do this, and give up. Or it might be to continue trying, but yet to always live in fear that somehow, some way, you're breaking one of those rules and you're not going to pass the eternal test. Both of those views of the Bible, and consequently, both of those views of God, are in error. Now, with that being said, does God expect us to give great respect to His commandments? He absolutely does. Does God expect me to obey the commandments that He's given? He absolutely does. But what I would like for us to do in this study today is to talk about how we view the commands of God, and to avoid this attitude of, there's all of these rules in the Bible and I just can't do it. I can't follow all of those rules. And I believe the way that we avoid that kind of attitude is to understand the intentions that come behind the commands of God. To begin this study, we're going to begin as we have been doing in several sermons recently, and that's to go to the Garden of Eden. Within chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the Bible, we find much of what the remainder of the Bible is going to be built on, and I believe we find that here as well. So, by way of reminder, let's consider why God created humans. He had an extremely noble purpose in mind for His creation. And this is expressed to us in chapter 1, verse 28 of the book of Genesis. Here we read, "And God blessed them," talking about Adam and Eve, "and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living creature that moves on the earth." Here God is saying, you are in my image, and I want you to populate the earth with other humans in my image. That was a major responsibility. And He says, I want you to join with me as partners in this creation, because you're going to go into the earth and you're going to subdue it. And you're going to have dominion or control over the beast and over the birds and over the fish of the sea. God is saying, I want you to be a part of ruling this creation with me. To do that, however, Adam and Eve first had to understand the need for God's wisdom. To be a partner with God in this creation demanded that they learn God's wisdom. I'm convinced that Adam and Eve were created as mature human beings, that they were not created as little children who grew up. But with that said, it is very likely that as far as their understanding of things is concerned, it would have been quite childlike. Because what God desired was to bring them into this understanding of His wisdom. So how do we see God attempting to do that? When we read the description of the Garden of Eden, we read three things about trees. For one, we know that all of the trees of the garden, except for one, were given for food. One of the trees was given to grant life. But yet there was another tree that was there that was totally off limits to Adam and Eve. In fact, God warns them about this tree in chapter 2 and verse 17, when he says, "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." So this stood in contrast to the tree of life. The tree of life, they could make the choice to eat of it and to live. However, for the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they would die if they ate of it. Here was God's plan to train Adam and Eve. He wanted them to understand that it was He and God alone who contained the true knowledge of what good and evil is all about. That He is the one who could explain satisfactorily to His partners in the creation what it meant to be good and what it meant to be bad. And thus, within this tree, they would have learned the standards of God from God. That was the ideal. That was the picture of what God intended. We know, however, that the serpent comes along. And the way that he seeks to tempt Adam and Eve is to tempt them into defining good and evil by themselves. In other words, he says, cut out God as the middle one. What you need to do is to understand this on your own. And so the temptation went something like this. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. God said, I want to teach you the difference between good and evil. The devil said, you can learn good and evil on your own and you can be like God. And we know the rest of the story. Because of pride, Eve ate of this tree. And in rebellion, Adam ate of it as well. And so this plan of the serpent succeeded. And because of this failure, there is exile from the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve have forfeited this grand purpose they were given. Adam and Eve have forfeited paradise. Adam and Eve have forfeited being able to eat from the tree of life. And on the day that they sin, they begin that process of dying. What a sad story that is, yet what we understand is that this story is repeated time and time again throughout the Bible. For example, we find the same idea, the same really metric, when we come to Israel as they enter into nationhood. In many ways, this is going to be the Garden of Eden, part two. We understand some of that even from the description of the land that God said He was going to give to them. He said, I'm going to take you to a land that flows with milk and honey. In other words, a paradise setting. That's no accident. God is reminding us of the Garden of Eden, and what He's going to do is to make a very similar offer to the nation of Israel as He did with Adam and Eve. So whereas God has given mankind, human beings, this noble purpose of populating the earth, He also had a noble purpose for the nation of Israel. And so what was that? Well, as God is calling them to nationhood, we read in Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6, the covenant, the contract that God makes with them. He says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." So as the people are gathered there at Mount Sinai and God is ready to bring them into this covenant relationship, He lays out the terms for them. But there's one of these principles that I want us to look at a little more depth. The idea of being a kingdom of priests. When we think about the nations being a kingdom of priests, what we understand in this is that they are to be examples to the world. When we think about Israel being priests, we don't need to think about that in terms of the Levitical priesthood. Instead, we think about priest in its more universal sense as one who is going out to explain the ways of another, to prepare a relationship to take place between two parties. So the goal that God has for the nation of Israel is to go out to the other nations and allow them to see what it looks like to be the people of God. That's their purpose. Now think about the Eden connection here. As Adam and Eve were to populate the earth with those made in the image of God, Israel was to show the population of the earth what it meant to live like one created in the image of God. And when the nation hears this and the offer to become a holy nation, they very readily accepted. They answered and they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. So here we find the offer being made and the offer being accepted. Now, after this point, we're going to come to all those rules. This can be the death of many daily Bible reading programs. When you get to the latter part of Exodus and the book of Leviticus, you come across all of these laws that to our modern Gentile minds just don't make a great deal of sense. And so we begin viewing those laws kind of like the driver's manual. Here we think, well, all of this was handed to the people and this was their expectation. They were to commit all these to memory and to live in this way. And we really miss an important point of what God expected. So what is that point? Well, to answer that question, we've got to understand the purpose behind these laws that were given to the nation of Israel. In Deuteronomy and Leviticus, we come across two passages that in Matthew 22 we have recorded Jesus putting together. Someone comes to Jesus and says, "What is the greatest law? What is the greatest command?" And so Jesus drops back to Deuteronomy 6 and Leviticus 19, and he answers the man, well, here it is. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Now, while we find those separated within the law of Moses, note that Jesus put them together, and he treats these two things as really one command, though he says the second unto it is, love your neighbor. The point that he's making is, you can't have one without the other. You can't love God and hate your neighbor, nor can you love your neighbor and hate God. These two fit together. So, as we approach these laws that we find, we understand they were not just these arbitrary rules. God didn't just sit in heaven one day and say, "Let me think of the most arcane and mundane and difficult things I can, because this is really going to put the people to the test. I'm going to see if they'll memorize them, and though it makes absolutely no difference, see if they carry them out." To look at the law that way is to miss the entire point of what it's all about. Because far from being arbitrary, far from just simply giving a bunch of things for the people to follow, what these laws did was to teach how to love God and how to love one's neighbor. This is very easily seen in the first 10 of the laws that are given. When we think about the Ten Commandments, we easily see this. So how do you love God? Well, you have no other gods before. How do you love God? Don't make any graven images. How do you love God? Don't go out acting like the people of God, but sinning all the time. You don't take His name into the world in a vain kind of way. And you remember the Sabbath, because this is a day that is holy to Him. So here at the very foundation of the law, we find it ensconced that you are to love God. And what about the other commands? Honoring father and mother? Thou shalt not kill or commit adultery or steal. Not bear false witness against your neighbor. Here are those neighbor commands. Your father and your mother, you respect them. You treat life in a very good way. You treat your spouse in a very good way. You don't disrespect the property of someone else. And then, with the word neighbor built in, you certainly don't bear false witness. But then I want you to note the 10th command, thou shalt not covet. Once again, that links us straight back to the Garden of Eden. Eve looked at the fruit, and the idea is there that she coveted that fruit. And so what is God saying here? He's saying, you shall not covet. He's tying that in with your neighbor's property, but nonetheless, he's giving us that key back to the Garden of Eden. Don't try to take what you don't want, what you don't need to have. Now, as we go through the rest of the laws, it's not as easy sometimes as we find here to see the principle of loving God and loving neighbor. But yet, if we look hard enough and deep enough, every one of those laws is going to come back in one way or the other to one of those two concepts. Here, we find the same thing that God expected in the garden. Just as He wanted Adam and Eve to learn His wisdom and to live by His wisdom, that's what He wanted for Israel. He said, I want you to seek My ways, and these laws are pointing you toward My ways. Here is the revelation of My wisdom to you. That's how you can be a holy nation. That's how you can be a kingdom of priests to go out into the world. Sadly, though, we know that Israel was very much like Adam and Eve. Where Adam and Eve coveted and fell, so we find for the nation of Israel. That though they had been called into this great covenant with God, and though the mind of God had been revealed to them in these laws, what we find in much of the first five books of the Bible is really the story of self-desire. There is very much a rhythm to reading these books. As we look at these books and we begin to get into these sections that have a lot of the laws listed, if you'll note, you'll have a big section of laws followed by a cataclysmic failure. So here is an example of how they did not respect the laws of God. And you read about this, and then you go to another section of laws, and it's followed by this failure. And so what God is driving home is, I gave this nation such an opportunity. I gave them the opportunity to know Me and to walk with Me and to be My people and to be My partner in this. Yet, they too have looked upon the forbidden fruit. And from it, they have eaten. Their very loyal and faithful leader tried to warn them about this. In fact, as Moses is getting near the time of his death, we find that he is giving them speeches and sermons about how to behave. And I'd like for us to look at one of those, or a portion of one of them, in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Let's read together what he says here, beginning in verse 9. He says, the Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the works of your hand, in the fruit of your womb, and in the fruit of your cattle, and in the fruit of your ground. For the Lord will again take delight in prospering you, as He took delight in your fathers, when you obey the voice of the Lord your God, to keep His commandments and His statutes that are written in this book of the law, when you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. For this commandment that I command you today is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it? Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you can do it. See, I've set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in His ways, by keeping His commandments and His statutes and His rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Here is a new generation of the people of Israel. Here are people who have seen what God can do, and what Moses is saying is, this law is not too hard for you. What I have commanded you today, you can do it. But I've chosen this section for a reason. What I want us to see is that Moses is using language here to remind them of the Garden of Eden. Let's look at the examples of that. What do we find? He says, before you today, you've got the choice of life or death. What did Adam and Eve have? They could eat of the tree of life and live, or they could eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil and die. Here is that choice. And just in case we didn't get that, what does Moses add here? He says it's the choice of life and good or death and evil. Here he's saying to them in a little bit of a mysterious way, you need to think back to what Adam and Eve were offered. They had the opportunity to learn this from God, and they didn't, but you can. Well, we're still not done, are we? As we continue on, we find this idea of walking with God. And if you remember back in Genesis chapter 3, the text tells us that God was walking in the garden in the cool of the day when He called out to Adam and said, "Where are you?" The picture that we have here is that this was a time of learning. That there was an occasion when God would walk with Adam and Eve. And as He walked with them, He was teaching them His ways. And so that metaphor of walking continues throughout the remainder of the Bible, which Moses uses here. And he says, if you'll listen to God, God's going to walk with you when you walk with Him. But we're still not done. He continues and he says, if you obey Him and keep His statutes and His rules, then you'll live and multiply. You remember the command that Adam and Eve were given? You're to multiply and begin filling the earth. And one final thing. He says, if you'll do all of this, God is going to bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Just as humanity was to subdue and to dominate the earth, Israel in miniature here is given Canaan, what? To subdue and dominate. And it is to become a land where the people walk with God, where they are living and where they are doing good, and thus they are avoiding those things that can eternally destroy. Moses lays the Eden covenant right at the doorsteps of this new generation. But sadly, we know the rest of the story, don't we? That as Adam and Eve failed, so too did Israel. And as Adam and Eve were exiled from the Garden of Eden, so God exiled Israel from the good land that He had given to them. So then, the Old Testament is basically a series of readings that show us people who are brought to the challenge, but yet they fail. And we might get depressed and we say, well, can anybody do this? Is there any way that anybody's going to be able to follow God? And then we understand that Jesus comes to the rescue. There is so much we could discuss in this point, but I'm going to keep it to a minimum in terms of keeping it in pace with the topic we're looking at today. When Jesus came to earth, what did He do for us? He demonstrated what obedience looks like. Basically, God said, well, I'm seeing that no human is going to do what I want them to do. So I'm going to put on the flesh of humanity. God will become human to demonstrate to humans how God is to live. And thus, when Jesus came to the earth, He demonstrated in fullness what it looks like to be an obedient human to the ways of God. Let me tie a passage in from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount here. In Matthew chapter 5, He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota nor a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever releases, or rather relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. What a tremendous passage. And as we come to this, we oftentimes use it to denote the differences of the covenant. And that's a good use of this passage. That here Jesus is fulfilling the old covenant, closing the chapter on it, and then showing us what everything pointed to. But for our study today, let me remind you that there's something else in that fulfillment. What Jesus is doing is showing how to obey. He is fulfilling in the sense that He's taking all of these things, and during His earthly life, He is fully obedient to that law that was given. And if anybody thought that Jesus wasn't concerned about it, they had better keep reading where He says, you better not relax any of these laws. They're all important. And then He gets to the crux because He says, if you do not respect what God has given, then your righteousness is no better than the scribes and the Pharisees. You'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. So what do we find here? We find Jesus affirming that obedience is important. But we also find that Jesus is setting the example of how to obey. And so what do we find then? That it's through His obedience that there's a better way for us. The covenant that God made with Israel with the series of laws was completed in Jesus Christ. He showed how to fulfill that. He showed how to accomplish that. But yet that covenant was never intended to be permanent. And what God has done by coming in the flesh and demonstrating this obedience to us and preparing a better way, He has given opportunity for us to be a part of the covenant that had long been prophesied. The writer of Hebrews understood this by the inspiration of the Spirit. And so as he begins to distinguish between these covenants, this is what he has to say. He says, but as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant He mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for the second. But now note this line, for He finds fault with them. When He says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord. And He's going to quote here from the prophecies of the Old Testament. He says, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on that day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in My covenant. And so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put My laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. And then we find the phrase that permeates the Bible. And I will be their God, and they shall be My people. Was the law of Moses a bad law? Absolutely not. It was given by God. Was it a law simply to give a bunch of random details that you had to fulfill? Not at all. It was a revelation of the wisdom of God. But what God says is, when I look at man's relationship to that law, I see fault with them. I see their failure. But I'm looking forward to something better. When My Son comes and He demonstrates what it looks like to obey God, and He sets the pattern for seeking the wisdom of God and not eating of the forbidden fruit. And He says, when that covenant comes, for those who choose that covenant, My law will be written in their hearts and minds. This covenant will be in their lives. That's what God has promised. So then, through Jesus, we have this very beautiful picture of what the new covenant is to look like, what this better covenant is to look like. But what I want us to understand, that though the commands in some cases are very, very different, the goals are absolutely the same. As God expected Israel to learn to love God and neighbor, those who are in covenant through the blood of Jesus Christ are expected to do the exact same thing. And every command that Jesus gives is pointing to that idea of how to love God and how to love neighbor. If there is any doubt about that, we simply read what Jesus said as recorded by the Apostle John. If we ever think that God doesn't expect the same fidelity to the commandments given through the covenant with Jesus as He did with the old covenant, we are sadly mistaken. Note what Jesus says when He says, "If you love Me, you will keep My commandments." What if we didn't get that? Well, we continue reading in verse 21. "Whoever has My commandments and keep them, he it is who loves Me. And he who loves Me will be loved by My Father, and I will love him and manifest Myself to him." Or if we miss that one, we go to verse 23. "If anyone loves Me, he will keep My word, and My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Or we could read verse 24, "Whoever does not love Me does not keep My words, and the word that you hear is not Mine, but the Father's who sent Me." Four times over, Jesus says, in this covenant that I am bringing in, the way you are going to demonstrate your loyalty and your fidelity to Me is to respect My commandments. As a part of this new covenant, as a part of this better covenant, there is still the requirement that when I tell you something, that you respect it, and that that respect and love is shown through obedience. So then, as we consider these things, we return to an extent back to the point that we started with. As we have seen the failure of Adam and Eve, and as we've seen the failure of Israel, but yet we see this grand picture of Jesus who came into this earth, of God taking on the flesh of humanity to demonstrate what obedience looks like, to demonstrate what it means to seek the wisdom of God. In Him, we find our way back to the Garden of Eden. So what does that mean for us then? That means that we need to pay attention to these commands of the new covenant. That when Jesus says, "If you love Me, you keep My commandments," we understand that is not just a rote keeping. It's not simply coming in and with mindless action, clicking off a box, checking a box, and saying, "Well, I've got that accomplished, so obviously I love Jesus because I kept His command." To have that kind of understanding is to miss the entirety of the Bible. God has never wanted that. As Moses spoke to Israel, He said, "The obedience that you're showing is to show your love for God, not just simply a way of being saved." So what about the commands of the new covenant? When we look at these commands, what Jesus wants us to do is to understand the why behind them. To look at this not as a series of rules, but rather to see what they represent. So let's use an example. One of the Ten Commandments that was brought forward into the New Covenant was, "You shall not murder." God has always insisted that we respect life. So as He is teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, He makes this point about it. He says, "I want to demonstrate to you why you're not to kill." And so here's what He says. "You've heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, and the text goes on to say you leave your gift, you go and reconcile to your brother, then you come back and offer your gift. What's the point? It is exactly right that we are not to kill one another. But Jesus says, I want you to see the love for your neighbor behind that. Here is someone who is created in the image of God. And not only are you not to kill this person, you are also not to have this outrageous, insulting anger at the person, where you would utter something like, you fool, which is kind of shorthand for saying, when I look at you, I do not see a fellow human. I see someone who is a non-human. Jesus says, that doesn't cut it. That is not loving your neighbor as you love yourself. So we cannot simply check the box and say, well, I love Jesus because I've never killed someone. Jesus says, the way that you are faithful to me is when you are realizing that principle, that as I loved people, that as I demonstrated this as I walked the earth, you too are going to demonstrate that same kind of attitude of love for your neighbor. So then, when I approach these things, what am I seeing? I'm seeing a reason behind the command. Therefore, I must not approach these commands like a driver's manual. I must not come to the Bible and simply see this series of arbitrary rules, arbitrary commandments, look at them and say, well, there's no way I can do that. There's no way I can follow all of those rules. We are indeed blessed by the grace of God. And we are blessed with a merciful and forgiving God. But God has this very distinct and sober expectation for us that when we look at His commands, we are not looking at some surface level rule. We are looking at these in such a way as to understand who He is. So then, if I am going to be faithful to this covenant, what am I doing? I'm seeking to be like Jesus. How do I do that? I listen to the commands that He gave. And not only that, I read what's recorded of His life so that I can see how He interacted and how He washed the feet of His apostles and how He took the message of salvation to those who were on the outskirts of society and how He cared for the poor. And I look at that and I say, here is my picture of how to love my neighbor. And I look at the deep respect that He gave to the Father, how He said, not my will, but your will be done. And I see in that the greatest commandment, an example of it, of how you love God with everything you've got. You see, Jesus is my model. And the covenant that He gives to us is built on what He modeled while He was on earth. To be faithful to the covenant, I seek to be like Jesus. I look then to the failures of the past. I look at Adam and Eve, and I look at Israel, and I see where they tried to self-define their own wisdom and their own understanding. And I realize I cannot repeat that mistake. That when I am looking for true wisdom, it's God's wisdom that I seek. And when I seek God's wisdom, what I'm doing is allowing God to define good and evil. Since the dawn of time, this has been an important point. But in the times in which you and I live, it is certainly very, very present of the need that we have to understand this. We are in the midst of watching people redefine good and evil. Literally, in some cases, changing dictionary definitions to make something that was once considered evil to appear good. Of making laws to honor and protect things that are evil in the sight of God. There's going to be, and already is, a great temptation for us to eat of that forbidden fruit. To say, well, maybe that makes a lot of sense. Maybe the Bible is out of date. Maybe all these rules don't apply to me. And to view that shows we never understand the purpose behind those commands of God. The commands of God, just as they were for Adam and Eve, are given to help us mature spiritually, to become what God desires, what we were created to be, so that we can fully take up that partnership with Him. So just in case the point hasn't been made already, how do we define the wisdom of God? Listen to what Paul said. He says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and the Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, and folly to the Gentiles. But to those who are being called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." How do we define good and evil? We do not. Jesus does. And as you and I look at His life, and we look at the commands He's given, here is the wisdom that's being given to us. And if we appreciate that, and we follow Him to the best of our abilities, and understand that grace and mercy is ever present when we fail, we can then have what God has wanted all along. So it's no surprise when we come to the book of Revelation. And as we look in Revelation chapter 2, one of the rewards that was promised to the churches of Asia was this: "To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." For those who follow Jesus, God says, Eden will be yours. I encourage you never to look at the Bible as some kind of rule book manual. Are there rules there? Absolutely. Are there commands there? Absolutely. Are we to follow those? Absolutely. But you and I now see fully what it's all about. It's becoming like Jesus so that we can have what God has always wanted us to have through that obedient Son. I hope this lesson has been helpful to you. And as you think about these things, don't ever put off becoming a Christian because you say, I just can't do it. I just can't follow all those rules. Two things about that. First of all, yes, you can if you allow God to take control. Now, that doesn't mean something mysterious and miraculous is going to happen and you go into self-drive mode here and God takes the wheel or whatever. It's not that. But it's the idea of letting God have that control, that you're following Him. And secondly, yes, there will be times, very likely in your life, when commands are going to be violated. We don't excuse ourselves for that. We don't say, well, that's just the way it is. We're sorrowful for those times. But yet we understand that God in His graciousness is there to help us, not hurt us. And through His loving forgiveness, He lifts us up for another opportunity to please Him. By the grace of God, you can be saved. If you're ready to do that today, you just let me know. And we will make that happen as soon as we can so that you can be buried in the waters of baptism for salvation. Or if you failed and you're ready to come back and to learn about this grace of God again, just let me know that too and I'll help however I can. Let's be that people who are on our way to Eden, to forever live in the shadow of the tree of life in the paradise of God, in full fellowship and partnership with our Lord and Savior. Thank you so much for joining in this study today.